Hello, everyone. This is Jerry Pippin, and welcome to our UFO show. From upstate New York, at his home, we have Richard Dolan. Richard is a major, major icon in the UFO business. How are you, Rich?
Hi, Jerry. Thanks for having me on. And next time anyone calls me a major icon, I know that you did it first.
Well, you know, I started not to call you a major icon because it kind of sounds like you're like me on your last legs.
I hope not. I hope neither of us are.
I hope I'm not either.
Exactly. But that was very, very nice of you to say that, and you just made my evening.
First of all, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention that you know how to celebrate New Year's Eve. You went to Philadelphia.
Wow, I sure did. And
hey, actually, it was a good cause, right?
Yes, absolutely. It was a fundraiser for a local library, nonprofit kind of a event. And I was asked, Karen Dolan, my wife, was asked to go down there. And Peter Robbins, all of us gave presentations for a local Philadelphia MUFON-oriented group. And it was very, very pleasant. It was very nice. You know, a lot of these small gatherings that I'll do large ones, I'll do small ones. And the small ones are really nice because, A, you really get to talk to a lot of the folks one-on-one. And typically, there's just a lot of engaged, very interested people. And it was a very nice experience for sure.
It was a very good cause, I guess, a public access channel, a show there that you were helping to benefit?
Absolutely, that's right. That's exactly right. It was organized. A lot of it was really initiated by my very good friend Jennifer Stein, who is one of the most energetic and just good people working in the field of ufology. Jen's work is more behind the scenes. She's not a researcher, but wow, can she get things done. And if you're ever looking to have an event planned, she is a go-to gal for sure. And in Pennsylvania, she's really been responsible for a lot of very well-produced conferences that have been down there. And one thing I will add is that I spent New Year's Eve with Karen and Peter, and my kids were with me, Mike and Elaine, who are teenagers now, at the home of a family of magicians, and I was sawed in half on New Year's Eve.
So it actually happened to you, huh? They got you in the box and moved the saw around?
They did the whole thing. I laid down on a table, and it was like this little thing that was put over me, and there was this electric saber saw, and it just went right through me. Fortunately, I didn't look down too much because everyone said that it looked terrifying. But I came out of it.
I don't know if I should ask you too much about it. We don't want to give away any secrets. But
I don't know the secret, so I don't think the magician would tell me if I did ask. But I will say that the father, this is done by the son, but the father, who's very pretty active in MUFON also in Pennsylvania, is a highly accomplished magician, highly accomplished. And he's taught his son a lot of really cool tricks, too. So we had a good time.
Now, when you saw people in half, they pull that box that you're in apart.
We didn't do that.
And you can see your feet wiggling on one side. And did that happen to you?
No. Well, this is in the living room of a home, so it wasn't quite as high-tech as on stage. but it was very well done, I will say that. It was very well done.
Well, we started out talking about television. We ended up about magic, and there's something magical about television and video, and I noticed you're doing a lot of TV work these days.
Well, I don't really know what's appearing on TV. I actually very seldom watch myself on TV. Oh, I know there's always clips getting on there. I've just been shot for a couple of recently shot for a few things that will be on History Channel. One, an episode of Ancient Aliens. Did a lot of video for Ancient Aliens a couple of months ago, and I'm guessing that'll start appearing in whatever episodes they have out. And I shot a video for History Channel for an Area 51 special that will be out. I've been producing a lot.
When you did this Area 51 thing, did you go up to Area 51?
No, not this. This was shot for me in New York City. You know, for most of these TV documentaries, I think the majority of the sit-down interviews I have are either in L.A., that's the number one place, that's where most of the production companies are, or secondarily New York. Me being in New York State, it's a lot easier for me to get to most of the time. So, in fact, for this one, I just drove from Rochester to New York City. It's a drive I do frequently enough anyway, but it's a number of hours. You got to, you know, haul it across the state. But they set me up in Manhattan, and it was actually a really nice experience. I always make sure that I'm as super prepared as I can be for any of these interviews. So I felt very good going into it, and I'm hopeful that when it appears, it'll be useful and, you know, engaging for people to watch.
Yeah, now when we talk about Richard Dolan and these TV appearances, I notice a lot of your appearances at conferences, all of a sudden, are making the rounds on YouTube, at least parts of them.
Oh, God. You know,
how do you feel about that?
Well, I'm happy about it, to be honest with you. I my feeling is, look, the more, if I have any message to give, the more that it's out there, the better. There was a period in the early 2000s, say like up to 2005, 06, when it was kind of a neat little thing when I would be able to sell DVDs of various lectures and people would buy them. And they'd be like, oh, Richard Dolan on DVD. Oh, let me get that. Now, no one buys them. Everything's on YouTube. And I thought, well, that was fun while it lasted. But honestly, it's way better like this. First of all, I'm not in this to make the buck. I'm in this to do a certain amount of work, to do a lot of work, and to get a message out and to communicate whatever it is that I may have to say. And YouTube is such an ideal medium for that. Honestly, I find clips of myself on YouTube that I had no idea was out there. I just ran across a clip. Someone pointed it out to me a week ago, less than that, of an interview I did about a year ago at the first International UFO Congress that was held in Phoenix after it was moved over. I did a nice 38-minute interview. I'd absolutely forgotten all about it. And here I am looking at it. It's a nice high def. It was a good sound quality. It was a nice interview with the interviewer. And so what I did is what I always do is I put it up on my Facebook page and said, here, people, take a look. Didn't know that this was out there. I'm always very happy to see, as long as you know, it looks like it was a reasonably good interview, I'm very happy to get it out there. But the truth is I almost never watch my own interviews. You know, there are people who know what I say much more accurately than I remember what I've said, to be honest with you. I'll do an interview, and then I'm done with it, and I try to move on to other things.
We both feel probably about the same way about yourself later. I mean, we've already seen ourselves when we did it,
exactly.
And at least we have an idea of what we did, but it doesn't hurt occasionally to check in.
You say what you
and
say.
And see how you really look.
Yeah, and you move on, and that's what I always try to do. And for myself, too, I never want to get into a position where I'm saying the same thing year after year. I don't want to ever be that way. So what I always do, in fact, very consciously, is I try to evolve new themes for each year. What do I want to talk about? What do I want to focus on more in public presentations this year as opposed to last year? And I've noticed there's a definite evolution in the things that I talk about. So when I'm done with a topic, it's not that I forget about it, but the fact is that I'm usually busy focusing on new areas of interest, new areas of research that I feel are important. So I don't really have a whole lot of time, honestly, to study a lot of my interviews. And I don't want to say shocking. It's startling sometimes when I meet with people who know the things that I've said better than I know, which does happen.
Well, you have to take that as a compliment. That means you're doing good work.
I hope so.
These people are getting interested.
Well, there's a lot.
What's the topic du jour for 2012? You said you're interested in different things. Are you trotting out something new this year? Or
I'm writing a new book.
To talk about?
I've got a new project, which I'm very excited about. This came about initially as a request to teach an online university course on UFOs. And it's for it's an online university called the International Metaphysical University, or IMU. They're not accredited for college yet, but they are working on it. I think they've got a nice kind of program going there. And really what they do, as you might imply from the name, is that they deal with a variety of topics that are just a little off the beaten path from standard university curriculum. And they wanted to have a curriculum in ufology or UFO research. Didn't really have one, and ended up asking me if I would develop the course for an introduction to ufology, kind of the foundation for it. So I thought about
it. Kind of a ufology 101, huh?
Exactly. And really what they need is 12 distinct classes, 12 distinct lectures on topics of my choosing in the field. So I agreed to do it, and this was last summer. And I looked at it as an opportunity to think through the issues of ufology in as fresh a way as I could. And, you know, what is it about this topic, this field, this discipline that I personally have considered to be really the important key elements of the field? And so it gave me an opportunity to sit down and really, with as fresh fresh an approach as I could, try to think this through. And so I've started to do it. And what I realize is that each lecture really is equivalent in length to a standard chapter of a book. And so what I've decided to do is I'm doing the lecture series and I'm turning it into a book as well. And that's more than halfway done now. And I expect it will be completely done in a couple of months at the most. And then I'll publish it and get it out there. So it's for the course in Introduction to Ufology for this online university, IMU. I think I'm calling the book UFOs for the 21st Century Mind. That's my current working title. I think I may like that. And I think it sort of captures what I'm trying to do for this book. It's an attempt to give really what I want it to be is ideally the first best book for anyone who wants to learn about the UFO topic. If someone doesn't know anything, this should be the book for them. That's my goal. And I certainly intend it for experienced readers as well, as a new way to kind of reconfigure and synthesize what we know today about this topic, or what we think we know. This is not.
I got an email already, Rich. Somebody wants you to go over the details on that Internet University again, how they get involved in that.
Oh, well, by all means.
They're very interested in that.
That's good.
And, yeah, it is good, and I think it's a great idea.
It's called the International Metaphysical University. You can probably Google that. You'll get right to their page. I am listed on there as faculty, although the course is not yet live. So I'm doing a little search on it right now. Here we go. International Meta. It's intermetu.com. So it's a bit of an acronym. If you just Google International Metaphysical University, you'll get there, and you can kind of scroll on through there.
What is involved in that? Do you watch your lecture, and do you get study guides or something?
Exactly. So I'll have 12 lectures, which will be in audio form. I'll also be creating them as video, which will have visuals to go along with them, because they'll really need that. It's really like a college course. I'll create study materials. I'll be live online with people at least once a week for, an hour or more per second.
Yeah, do you have a certain time to do that?
Well, I got to create office hours, I guess. I'll have to set all that up, but that's part of the program, is that the student will have one-on-one.
So it's something we need to start paying attention to. And when you get that out and worked out, and when you're doing it,
it's funny.
Keep me abridged.
Yeah, I will. Before I got into the UFO field, I was working on a PhD at the University of Rochester, which, by the way, I've decided I think I'm going to at some point go back and finish that PhD in some form. But I taught courses at the University of Rochester, and I enjoyed it very much. This is long before I did UFO studies. So this will give me an opportunity in some way to get back into that groove a little bit and actually have some students and guide them along into this, you know, complicated, labyrinthian topic in many ways. It's, hopefully provide some good guidance and encourage creative thought on the process.
Well, you know, there's something enchanting, and maybe that's an unusual adjective to use, but enchanting about your approach, and Stanton Friedman does the same thing, an intellectual examination of UFOs, and others do as well. If I start naming people, I'll leave somebody out. But you were quite a history guy anyway.
That's my study. That's my discipline, exactly.
And so as a result of that, I think that's part of the charm of Richard Dolan is you're intellectual, yet you've got a good personality.
Well, thank you very much, Jerry. I do feel like for the field that we are in here, at least the UFO field, there's a lot of room for all kinds of ways to approach it. And in other words, there's room for people who are just very creative and speculative because we need speculative people to help think outside the box in this very mysterious field. But I strongly do feel that it's necessary to have individuals who have rigorous training because it's very easy to get lost at sea in the study of ufology. It's very easy to forget what constitutes valid evidence. It's very easy to kind of get hooked into groundless speculations. I think it happens in this field just about every single day now, in particular with the advent of Facebook and social networking. It's like everyone is talking to everyone, and in many ways that's a great thing. But unfortunately, I think part of the downside is that places like Facebook and YouTube and elsewhere can be like a rumor mill. So certain things go viral, they spread, and the next thing you know that old game in elementary school where you'd whisper into someone's ear, and then they'd whisper into the next kid's ear, and then it goes around the room, and by the time it gets back to you, it's something totally different. And that's kind of what happens every single day in the field of ufology. And there are certainly people who really live for that. They live for the drama. I don't live for the drama. I simply am trying to investigate and understand the greatest mystery of our time. There's enough drama in that so that I don't have to invent any extra.
Were you always interested in UFOs, Richard?
Yes and no. More no than yes, to be honest with you. I was born in 62. I grew up, in my like early teens. I used to watch Star Trek like everyone, and I was a big fan of the old Star Trek show. I used to watch Leonard Nimoy's In Search Of series when I was in my early teens, and I did think that was very cool. I remember thinking some of the ancient astronaut episodes that he did were very, very interesting. But I didn't have books on the topic. I didn't pursue it. I was into really science and baseball when I was growing up, and a little bit of history. As I got through my teen years, I got really into history. I lost all interest in any of the Star Trek-y kinds of things that I may have grown up in. Through my 20s, it was even more so. I was focused totally on political history, intellectual history, philosophy, literature, and so on. And it wasn't until my early 30s, and this would be now by the early 1990s, mid-1990s, that I became, it was a crazy thing, Jerry. It was in 1994, and it was as though within a period of a month or two, I went from zero to being obsessed. I mean, not even interested. I would say obsessed. It was a dramatic turnaround in my life, and it wasn't caused.
Can you pinpoint why that happened?
Well, not 100%. I mean, there were two moments that I distinctly feel were important. One was a moment in a bookstore where I saw a copy of Timothy Good's Above Top Secret. And that was an important moment. And of course, that's a real classic in the field. The subtitle of that book, which was what really got me, was the Worldwide UFO Cover-Up. And it's a nice big fat book. It was sitting on a display in a store. And I picked it up. Now, that book had been out for some time by then, but it was new to me. And I just remembered thumbing through the book. And immediately, for anyone who's seen the book, they know it's a well-put-together book. There's a lot of documentation. There's a lot of international stories involved and a lot of political figures, people that I knew about, guys whose diaries I had read or listed in the book, departments I'd studied. And that moment was one of a tremendous cognitive dissonance for me personally. It was basically, here's me, who I thought I was ahead of the curve in understanding how my world worked and how everything was put together. And I'm encountering this reality here that was so radically different. It was, you don't study UFOs in the academic world, not in any serious way. It just isn't done, hardly at all. But here is a book that was essentially telling me that my worldview was either totally wrong or woefully inadequate. And I can tell you, it wasn't a fun thought to entertain. No one enjoys that thought, especially if you become very serious on a certain track and your goal is to understand the world and ideally to teach history, which was my goal at the time. Yet I bought the book, and I could not help but be persuaded by the presentation. The other thing that really was equally important, and maybe more important at a certain point, was the early internet. Now, in 1994, there was no web really to speak of that was worth browsing. But there were news groups. There were quite a few of those. And I used to hang out on one group that was Alt Paranet UFO. I'm sure there are people out there who remember this. And in the early mid-90s, it was a happening place. There were a lot of people who would post articles and put their ideas up there. And there was one fellow up there who really, I have to say, showed me how to do this. He's not a researcher that people know. He's a guy who lives in Missouri, Columbia, Missouri. His name is Val Gurman. He's a friend of mine to this day. Val is a guy who was always sort of a amateur, I mean, in the best sense of the word. He didn't really want to go into this and do conferences or write books. But he wrote articles that looked at ufology in a political, with a political analysis, with a good political analysis. And I thought, bingo, that is what I want to do. That's what I need to do. And at that moment, that with Tim Good's book, I thought, I want to do the UFO topic. I want to do it right, and I want to do it with an appropriate political analysis, analyzing the cover-up. And really, I mean, it's crazy to say this now, almost 20 years later, but at that time, there really was almost nothing in UFO literature, if you really go back, that did any true analysis of the cover-up. In fact, there was none. There was a book called Clear Intent on the UFO. And really, but what that did was it threw out a lot of the Freedom of Information Act documents that showed that there was strong interest, and that's important. But there was no analysis. And so what I tried to do is to set out to do exactly that. And now I think that there's a number of people who are trying to do that, and I'm one of them. But in the early 90s, mid-90s, there were really no good examples that I had to work off of that tried to do this on a consistent basis, except my friend Val, who put out a couple of very good articles. And as I say, he kind of showed me, opened the path. And I'll always be grateful to him for that.
Richard Dolan is our guest, and we're talking naturally about UFOs and the conspiracy and the cover-up and a few other things that Richard's interested in. And I've already had a couple of emails at jerry@jerrypippin.com. We have several people in the chat room. We'll probably go to that as well, Rich, before we let you off. Mm-hmm. But you mentioned the cover-up and the conspiracy angle and everything just before I did my little spiel here. Mm-hmm. And while you were talking about that, I kept thinking about the whitehouse.gov website, and you and Bryce Sable put up something in December as well.
That's right.
How did that go? Did you get very many people interested? I mean, your question was actually pretty straightforward. You said, "Why don't you investigate?" I guess basically is what you asked.
Mm-hmm.
Shouldn't we investigate? I mean, no, I guess it's in response to them saying they don't investigate.
Right. Exactly. The petition was, you know, the White House is only since September of this last year allowed for a process of giving petitions of creating a petition for the government. Before September of 2011, there was no website that the White House had that allowed for this. Now, it was our friend Stephen Bassett of Paradigm Research Group who really saw this opportunity, and Stephen put out the first petition in October. He didn't waste a whole lot of time, got one out there, and basically to demand the White House recognize UFO phenomenon as ET. That got over the minimum amount of 5,000 signatures, so the White House was forced to reply. They gave a pretty lame reply, but really what else are they going to say, honestly? During the process of that petition, they upped the minimum amount from 5,000 to 25,000. And you got to think, holy smokes, that's five times the initial amount that they put out there. So by the time Bryce and I decided to do one, and for us it was a last minute thing. We had not really planned to do a petition, I'll be honest with you. We did it because Steve Bassett wrote to both of us in preparation for his second petition, and we were two of the people that he consulted with over the language of his next petition. And really, Bryce and I just talked privately, and we thought, you know, we could do a petition, so why don't we do one? And we felt that the one we had was a very appropriate one, and it just, as you mentioned, it was a call for the White House to investigate unknown aerial phenomena. We didn't even say UFOs. We said UAP, which we stated has been an issue within the national security community for years, and that we wanted a transparent investigation, materials declassified, and the findings made public. That was essentially what we demanded. So we put the petition out there. It started off with a fair amount of steam, and it trailed off. So we got about 2,000 signatories. And incidentally, Bassett on his second one got only a little bit more than that. So both of our petitions were essentially dead in the water. Part of the problem was that we had huge numbers of people emailing us saying, "What is wrong with the White House website? I've tried and tried and tried to register. They won't let me register. I keep getting kicked out." This went on for the entire month, Jerry. I really have no idea, but it would not shock me if we lost 1,000 signatures or more. There were so many people who just gave up trying because the White House website wouldn't allow them to,
quite a few,
to sign
I
up.
Think.
It was a lot. And it was disheartening, to be honest with you, because we really thought we had something that was worthwhile there. And, you know, the White House, what they say is, well, it really was a glitch. We're sorry about it. There's not much we can do about it. You can try again next time. That's essentially where we're at. The petition period, you get 30 days to get the signatures necessary. If you don't get it, it's gone.
You know, on the Internet, and I've been broadcasting on the Internet for some time, people just kind of gloss over the idea. If you go to a website and something doesn't work, you lose a huge percentage of the people.
Yeah,
they don't hang around.
Right.
And
right.
That's always been a problem, and sometimes techies don't seem to understand it.
Well, we were frustrated in one sense because this is during the month where, of course, the famous incident of the police officer pepper spraying members of Occupy Oakland, you know, just sprays them and walks by. And so you get all these people talking about this and people really going out there and sacrificing themselves for a certain cause. And we're thinking, well, my goodness. So there's an occasional glitch with the website and for this issue of disclosure or getting government announcement, we can't even get people to just stick around and fight with a website for a little while. But you're exactly right. Folks will go so far, they'll play with the website.
I mean, we've been doing this for well over a decade, and we still have problems, and it drives me nuts when it happens.
Sure.
Let's go to some phone calls, okay?
Mm-hmm.
We have a caller at the 619 area code. Caller, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Good. You're on the air with Jerry Pippin and Rich Dolan.
Yes,
go ahead, caller.
And it's a pleasure. Thank you very much, and it's a pleasure to hear from you again, Jerry. I'll say thank you to Richard Dolan. If I am on the right show, I'm not sure. I'm sure I'm calling long distance right now. But the question I have concerning these UFO reports and information about the reports itself, I have a big question.
Mm-hmm.
Have anyone have heard anything about a mass abduction?
Well,
say that again. I didn't understand it. Rich probably got it, but ask that question again.
He said, has anyone heard of a mass abduction?
Okay.
And the answer is yes. There are a couple of cases where there have been apparent mass abductions, for sure. It depends on how many people you're talking to count as a mass abduction. Certainly, the one that came to my mind immediately is one of the most famous events in UFO history, and that would be the Manhattan abduction of 1989, featuring a woman known as Linda Cortile. That's not her actual name. That's the name she goes by, which Bud Hopkins wrote about in his book called Witnessed. I actually did a little bit of some follow-up investigation of that case a few years ago, and I spoke with a few of the individuals who worked for the New York Post at that time as truck drivers. And keep in mind, this is a case in which everything was taking place at like 3 in the morning. So in downtown Manhattan, New York Post truck drivers are very busy picking up the post and getting ready to deliver it throughout the city. So a number of these guys were there when this event happened. And of course, it's also been rumored, and Bud Hopkins was never happy that I mentioned this in my book. And Bud and I were very, very good friends, but he didn't like the fact that I mentioned the fact that UN Secretary General Javier Perez de Cuellar was said to have himself been abducted during that event. And the point is that encounter, this is November 1989, was one that it certainly appears that there was a mass abduction. There were a number of people who were taken, not just the UN Secretary General, not just Linda Cortile, but I think at least one of the truck drivers that I spoke to, and probably a few others. There's another couple of cases that Bud investigated that I recall. I can't remember the details, but I know that we're talking about multiple people being abducted.
Well, sir, have you heard?
Go ahead, caller.
Yes, have you heard anything about any military involvement with these mass abductions at all? I mean, I heard one concerning Fort Benning, Georgia, and I've been involved with this investigation for like 20 years, and I mentioned this mass abduction, several times over with the panel and also a convention that I was involved with. And I visited your area once before, Mr. Dolan, and I really appreciated you're a very talented man. And I still want to continue with this inquiry about this mass abduction because of the fact that I did find some civil people, one of them, of course, passed away recently. His name was Command Sergeant Major James Thornton.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you've ever heard of him, but he was in the same area I was, and, of course, he passed away, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
However, I'm still continuing, like I said, to continue to find certain people that still...
Well, let me answer your question on this. The incident at Fort Benning, I have that book. And in fact, I met the gentleman who co-authored that book a number of years ago. And it seems to me that could have happened. The issue is whether or not there's really enough evidence that's going to stand up to a really, really tough critical scrutiny. I have to say he made a good impression on me. This is a long time ago when I met him.
Yeah. Rich, this is John Vasquez. He had a similar experience.
Exactly. This is John Vasquez calling.
Yeah, I'm John Vasquez. How are you doing?
John, we met.
I'm sorry to interrupt you.
No problem. We met, I don't know if you remember, I met you at a conference close to 10 years ago.
Yes, I remember. I think it was in Laughlin.
I didn't realize that this was you. I think that's right. And, I'm happy to tell you, you made a very, very positive impression on me, and I have your book. And my feeling is that what you say sounds very credible to me. And the other thing that I would like to add is that in the subsequent years, since you and I have met, I have investigated cases that I am convinced are military abductions. I'm not saying abductions of military personnel. I'm saying abductions by some kind of deep, super deep black ops group that's human, not ET. I am personally convinced that this goes on. And figuring out the relationship of those abductors as opposed to ET abductors is something that is high on my...
Yeah, I think it's really difficult. Hey, John, we've got to move on. I'm going to ask you one other question for you.
Okay.
Thanks for calling in.
Yeah.
How's the weather out in San Diego?
Oh, beautiful. Really beautiful.
Okay. Okay, listen, I'm going to ask Rich another question here. Thanks for calling, John. Rich, how do we know that John is a very serious guy, but how do we know that this is not some sort of MK Ultra experiment?
Well,
I don't guess we can.
It's hard sometimes. The human mind and human memory, unfortunately, can be manipulated. There are chemicals, there's techniques, there's hypnosis. There are things that can be done to take a person and inhibit their formation of memories while they're being taken. So in other words, a person can remain conscious during an abduction, but then be brought back and not have a good or even any memory sometimes of what happened. Or if they have a memory, it's fuzzy, or they wonder if it was a dream and, whatever. They sleep a little late that next morning and they're groggy, and the next thing you know, they're cooking meals for the kids and getting on with their life. In that type of a situation, who knows? Is it a human situation or is it a non-human situation? I can tell you, Jerry, I've spoken to a number of people now. I look for them, to be honest with you, and I almost feel like I know what to look for. Individuals who have been taken by U.S. deep black ops. I didn't even call it U.S. military, because I don't really think that this is an official part of the U.S. military. I think it's beyond military. And I think that there are certain markers about these people, and I'll just throw this right out there. I haven't written about this in any article, and undoubtedly I'm going to catch hell from certain people because they just don't believe that this is valid. But I believe that there are people of let's call it psychic abilities who are of interest to both human and non-human groups. And this is one important reason why they're being taken. Bud Hopkins, when he was alive, used to mention that, certain people appeared to be singled out for abduction. But he didn't really get into why this was the case. But I believe that one of the key reasons has to do with I think everyone is born with some level of what we would call psychic ability, but not all in equal amounts. It's like with any other kind of skill, whether it's musical ability or sports or what have you. We all may have some, but some people are very gifted and others less gifted. And I think it's the same with this, and that these people are of interest. And look, if you go through the history of UFO encounters, you find again and again and again kind of a telepathic connection that people have said that they have. And not simply people who claim that they've been channeling ET entities. I'm talking about witnesses of UFOs who somehow these other entities get into their head in one form or another. They react in ways emotionally that seem out of character for the situation, either unusually calmly, ridiculously calmly, or on the other hand, just over the top hysterical. You get both of these. And you get a lot of cases of what appears to be kind of a mental imagery that people have gotten. So there's a non-physical element to the interactions that people have with these other beings, and it's my opinion that they are interested in some humans who have got strong capabilities in that area. And I also believe this is one reason why the human black ops are also taking some of these people for the same reason.
You know, Richard, one of the common denominators I've found over the years with abductees or people who have been taken is they're much like John and many others. They just, it compels them. It's kind of like you and I when we suddenly got turned on UFOs, you know. All of a sudden, it's no longer an interest, it's a compulsion.
That's right.
They get people to believe them. And maybe this is one of the reasons there is a UFO cover-up. Do you think there's something? What do you think is really going on with abductions?
Well, a couple of things. One is there's no question in my mind that there's a breeding program going on of some sort. I think the evidence for this is overwhelming, at least in terms of witness testimony, abductee testimony. You get this from every single, especially the female abductees, who talk again and again about having been impregnated and having had their babies taken away again and again and again. It's just too much. So humans are being bred. Now, whether that's human ET hybrid or humans with other humans is a good question. I believe that there's both involved. Humans being bred with other humans who have the right lineage, whatever that lineage happens to be. And the only reason I say this is because I think I've stumbled onto a couple of those types of cases. So there's a breeding program. Now, what else might there be? Well, if my idea of people with psychic abilities are being taken is true, then I think that what's happened is that these people of psychic abilities are being used. They're being put to work in one form or another by ET, and especially by human black ops, clandestine groups, which are using these people basically, I would say, as counterintelligence, lack of a better word, to do remote viewing, to learn what they can learn about the nature of some of these other beings, which the impression that I get still mystifies a lot of the black ops. I don't think they really know everything that we think they may know. And part of what they do is use human telepaths, essentially, as part of their overall mission. Now, maybe there may be even more than this involved. I mean, I've had hints here and there that it's more than simply seeing across space, but across time. And anyone who's looked into the remote viewing phenomenon knows that there are many cases where it appears that remote viewers have seen events that have occurred in a different time stream or at a different time. And I think this is what's happening here.
Yeah, this abductee issue, every time I bring it up in a show that's live, the interest explodes. I have four or five emails here, two or three people in the chat room all of a sudden asking questions. And they basically are in two frames of mind. One is that abductees become very intuitive and spiritual healers, for lack of a better way to term. And others seem to think that it's some sort of a mental illness.
Well,
you know, I think, you know, for many years people didn't, Richard, do many shows on abductions because we just didn't understand it. And that's where this mental illness thing comes along.
Well, I have to say, one thing that happens to some abductees is they don't all become spiritually healthy and whole. I think the abduction phenomenon does harm to some of these people. Again, not everyone is the same, and not everyone has, a granite strong psychological foundation to start with. But some people who are taken are more vulnerable than others. I have spoken to quite a few people at this point, I can say, who I feel that the abduction experiences have not been helpful for them in their life, and they probably would be happier people without knowing what's been going on to them, but it's they don't have that luxury. So, you know, it can be an avenue for spiritual growth, as any kind of difficulty in life can be, of course, not simply to do with ET and abduction, but really it's possible to use anything in life as an avenue for spiritual growth. But not everyone surmounts the difficulties. There are things that happen during some of the experiences, at least I've looked into, that are genuinely distressing, that are not nice, that, you know, cases that I would consider to be essentially tantamount to rape have occurred, and various types of violence, whether sexual or non-sexual, and they're just unpleasant. So what does one say about it? You know, we're not all dealing with beings of lightness and goodness. I hate to say it, but at least my own sense is that there's a darker element that does exist in this phenomenon. And whenever I encounter individuals who only really see it as positive, and they say things like, the good-bad dichotomy is a false dichotomy, and, you know, you're creating negativity. All I want to say is I don't think these people have really done a whole lot of research. Because if you do enough research, you find that there is a disturbing as well as a positive element of this. My sense is that we're dealing with a complex reality. And if you look around at humanity, there's 7 billion of us now on planet Earth, and there are wonderful human beings who are saint-like and beautiful people, and then there are sadists and horrible people. Really, why should we think that entities that may have been around a little longer and have a little more scientific knowledge than we do, why should we think it would be any different? Why would we think that some aren't frivolous? Why would we think that some aren't actual, a waste of space in their own terms, and whereas others might be genuinely spiritually advanced? So I think this is the same with them as it is for us.
Yeah, when you're asking some questions, rhetorical questions, I've got a question for you right now. We talk about you deal with this in your books and your subject matter a lot, and that's the UFO cover-up.
Mm-hmm.
Why are they covering it up? What's the big damn deal?
A lot of reasons. One way to do this helpfully is to just rewind the clock, and let's all take a trip back to the 1940s. So 1945, World War II ends, and the entire world is basically lying on its back trying to recover from really the most convulsing cataclysm in modern history. Millions of people dead, millions more homeless. Europe was on the brink of starvation. People forget this. Much of Asia was in the midst of starvation. This was a really precarious situation. And it's in the immediate aftermath of that this new phenomenon now appears. In the early stages of the Cold War, you got the Soviet Union. Americans were kind of feeling that whole thing out. And now there are these objects that are being seen by entities and agencies unknown that appeared to have extraordinary capabilities, vastly beyond that of the U.S. Air Force. Now, just think about this. If you're the president and you're faced with a situation where the entire population only wants to return to a situation of normalcy, and now you're going to lay this down on them when you yourself don't really know what you're dealing with. And on top of that, to make it even more of a reason for secrecy, what if you've recovered some of their technology, as in Roswell or perhaps elsewhere? So it's not simply alerting the world to the presence of these other beings, but alerting the world to the fact that you've actually got some of their technology. And if you tell the world you've got that, it's going to be mighty hard not to share it eventually with other groups, other nations like the Soviet Union or like any other country that you are not sure you want to share this with. After all, the United States at that point had a monopoly of the atomic bomb, and they didn't want to share that technology with other nations. Why would they want to share something as exotic as this? So I think the answer is they wouldn't. I think the answer is Truman and his people would create a very, very highly classified group of top-level people, and their job would be to figure all of this out. to understand just what are we dealing with? What is this technology? Can we exploit it? Can we make money off of it? Can we use it to improve our military? You know, whatever. How bad would public panic be? You'd have someone, that's his job, he'd have to figure that out. Who's going to manage the media and the academic communities, and who's on point for that? And then we'll review this every so often and decide what our game plan will be. And I think that's exactly what they did. We can call that MJ-12 or Majestic 12. I think that's what they did. And then the problem becomes the secret continues more and more years. And secrets, you see, they have their own momentum. They develop their own raison d'être, their own reason to be, in which and their own profit. Because ultimately what will happen, I'm sure, is that the technology gets studied in deep, deeply clandestine facilities, private industry, and eventually people start getting nifty ideas on how to develop our own technology based on what they're looking at. So now they've got a goose that's laying golden eggs for them. They have now zero incentive for letting the rest of the world know, because you've got this technology of the future in your own hands. Why would they possibly want to tell the world about it? And so it just goes deeper and deeper and deeper. And what eventually happens is that this clandestine world, I think, ends up leaping so far ahead of the rest of the world in terms of what it knows, that it almost becomes a real difficult matter for even those who may want to bring the rest of us up to speed, but they're dealing with realities. They're dealing with science and cosmology and entities that essentially qualify them as a separate civilization. And I've called it sometimes a breakaway civilization, one that's broken away from our own to a large extent. So I think what's happened with the secrecy is that it's developed its own power, its own momentum. And it's very difficult for them to, I think, want to break out of that. In fact, it's my opinion that they never will do this voluntarily, but that nonetheless, see, they're not the only game in town, the secret keepers. There's these other beings, let's not forget them. And then the real dynamic of the equation, I would say, is us, the people. We're living in a society that is going through technological revolutions. Think about where we've gone just in the last 20 years. It's extraordinary. We're obviously not going to stop in the year 2012. We're going to continue. And what will our technology, what will our social communication abilities be like in another decade or two? It's almost impossible to imagine. I think what's going to happen is all of these developments, including stronger computing, stronger artificial intelligence in our personal computers and all of these things, are going to be the game changer. And they're going to force open the secret, so that the secret keepers are going to be, they're going to be forced to acknowledge something. And then, of course, they're going to give all the spin that they can give on it. And that's really where the fight for disclosure begins, not ends. You know, with an acknowledgement that there's something going on, we're going to have to continue to fight, guaranteed on this, to get actual truth. Because you can be sure that when there's a disclosure, there's going to be a fair amount of untruth packaged in with any truths we may get. There's a political
Mr. Dolan is our guest here, and we only have about 5 minutes left with Richard. But before I let you go, Richard, I got to ask you a couple of questions here. We're talking about Stephenville, and you just did something with Peter Robbins in Philadelphia, and he had the UK incident. And then we mentioned Area 51 earlier. Which one of these UFO stories fascinates you the most, or are they all pretty equal?
Well, the one that Peter wrote about, of course, the Rendlesham Forest case or the Bentwaters case in the 1980s, is one of the most important UFO cases ever, for a whole lot of reasons, more to go into than probably have time for. But I would rank the Stephenville case as right up there. I think in terms of evidence, it might be the best case of the 21st century so far, at least the best American case. The reason I say that is not simply the number of witnesses and the quality of those witnesses, but also the possession of FAA radar data. This was a real score by MUFON, and the investigators looking into it. In other words, getting confirmation by the Federal Aviation Administration that there was indeed an unknown object tracked over that area in Central Texas at that time. And that's critically important, because what you had from the witnesses is that there was this object that was as big as a Walmart. In fact, one person described it as a flying Walmart. That's about the scariest description I could imagine. When Walmarts fly, I'm out of this country. And it was this huge thing being chased by a whole bunch of F-16s. Now, the Air Force initially denied everything. They eventually admitted that, yes, there were some F-16s out on a training mission. They've never acknowledged that there was a UFO. But here's the thing. The FAA data did acknowledge that there was a UFO in that area. And the most critically intriguing thing about that, and this still blows my mind to this day, is that the last direction that object was seen going off to was the Crawford Ranch, which is where then-President Bush was staying at that time. And then the FAA said, well, we have no records after this. And I'm like, yeah, sure. How are you not going to have records on your, of this enormous, gargantuan object in the sky that outperforms F-16s, by the way, headed toward where the president was at that time? And you're going to tell us you don't have anything. Well, okay, to me, that's incredible.
But for a while, I'll let you go. How's the publishing business?
Well, I'm very happy with it. I've got a couple of books, not simply by myself. I mentioned UFOs for the 21st Century Mind, but I'm looking into publishing two books right now by other authors in the field. And as soon as we nail that down, I'll probably be talking more about it. But I'm very, very happy about it. I enjoy being a small-time publisher in this field. My biggest concern is always being able to do justice to the authors who entrust me with their book. I'm the publisher of a book by Dr. Richard Sauter, who writes on underground bases.
He seems to have gone to South America.
Yeah, he likes it there. I correspond with him pretty regularly. I think happily, for at least now, as an American expat, South America seems to agree with him, I guess.
Richard Dolan, it's always a pleasure having you on.
Oh, Jerry, I enjoyed our chat. It was a lot of fun, as it always is. Thank you.
And we'll talk to you again soon.
I hope so. I'll enjoy it, I'm sure. Thanks.
Richard Dolan was our guest.
I'm Jerry Pippin. Thanks for listening, everyone. Until next time, cheers.